Love by James Booth. Middle-aged, overweight and overworked, Larkin continues as librarian at Hull University, as well as writing poems, a jazz column and serving on national committees. He's still unable to commit to either Monica or Maeve, and his widowed mother's health is failing. The reader is Michael Pennington.
In January 1972, Larkin's mother fell and cracked a bone in her leg. It was no longer possible for her to stay in her own home, so on the 2nd of February, Eva made her final move into a nursing home. Larkin was deeply affected by his mother's loss of independence. He wrote to Barbara Pym in March, reluctantly conceding that Eva would never now return to her own home. "It's clear she can't go back to living as she did more or less on her own. Since Christmas, I've been going back there on Saturday and returning Sunday, which leaves considerably less time than usual for letters." Larkin holidayed with Monica in Wester Ross and wrote in their joint diary with disconcerting candour, "My specs are splashed with lobster. My lobster's splashed with snot. No woman makes my knob stir. A bloody cold I've got." On top of his other reasons for depression, his unhealthy lifestyle and heavy drinking were causing a loss of sexual vigour. Larkin was by now a national figure. In early April 1973, he and Monica were invited to a garden party at Buckingham Palace. He commented to his old friend from Belfast, Judy Edgerton, "Queen was pleasant enough, but I didn't have enough of her to lose my nervousness. I got on well enough with the keeper of the royal stamps." Larkin's professional life was becoming more stressful. Student numbers at Hull were growing inexorably, while staffing was being reduced. Between 1974 and 1977, there was a net loss of 13.5 full-time equivalent posts in the library, and the work was becoming technologically more complicated. A full-time archivist was appointed, and the first experiments in computerization were made. Larkin was never comfortable with the new technology, which he delegated. His mother was now 87. And in the midst of all his activities, he found time to keep her supplied with an unbroken flow of news and reassurance. In a one-page letter, he tells her, "It's a grey day here, windy and rather chilly." He describes an interview with a local radio station about the Oxford Anthology. "I had a nice letter from you this morning. Thank you for taking the trouble to write. I don't expect you've got your new spectacles yet, but I know they've been ordered. It'll be nicer when they come. You'll be able to read more easily." He inserts a charming cartoon of a seal in a mob cap reading a newspaper. There is something deeply moving about this lifelong correspondence, intimate, polite, and interminable. Larkin's final collection of poetry was named after the high-windowed room in Hull in which he had lived for most of the last two decades. Now, shortly after Christmas, he learned that this room was no longer to be his. The university intended to sell off some of its worst properties. Unable to contemplate buying the house himself and becoming a landlord, he was at last forced to own his own establishment. In February, Larkin wrote to Judy Edgerton, making as much lugubrious fun as he could of his situation. "I have blindly, deftly, and dumbly said I will buy an utterly undistinguished little modern house in Newland Park. I can't say it's the kind of dwelling that is eloquent of the nobility of the human spirit. It has a huge garden, not a lovely wilderness, though it soon will be. A long strip between wire fences. Oh, God, oh, God." He described the upheaval to the poet Anthony Thwaite. "I've been V-upset. Feel like a tortoise that's been taken out of one shell and put in another." When he moved house, he did at last have to furnish his life in the expected manner. He bought a new washing machine and no longer had the pleasure of wringing out his socks and underwear by hand as he had done all his life. He mourned the loss of his simple attic existence. He could not find a satisfactory place to work, so he recreated his flat, sitting in an armchair by the fire downstairs, his back to the garden, bookshelves within reach. Larkin's poetic future was bleak. He was aware of having all but completed his oeuvre, and his inspiration was guttering. He was struggling to keep up his spirits. Yet to all outward appearances, his life had reached its zenith of success. High Windows was universally praised, and he was awarded honorary degrees by St. Andrews and Sussex Universities. His evening routine had now settled into a pattern. Gin and tonic first, food accompanied by wine, then a nap, followed by a menthol cigarette and another drink before bed. Occasionally, he would host record-playing sessions with his jazz friends. His health steadily deteriorated. Early in 1976, one of the frequent estrangements from Maeve Brennan ended. Because the quarrel had lasted longer than usual, the reconciliation was particularly warm, and momentously, their relationship at last became fully physical. The new heady relationship with Maeve, delightful and fresh though it was not as simply serene for him as it seemed to her. When she went on a trip to Ireland, leaving Larkin to take his regular holiday in Scotland with Monica, he felt unaccountably bereft. He wrote to her on the 7th of August. "I wish you hadn't gone away just when you did. I miss you." A decade and a half after their relationship had begun, Larkin remained caught with a new intensity between his love for Maeve and his duty to Monica. When, later in the month, he travelled to Buckingham Palace for the CBE award ceremony, it was, of course, Monica who accompanied him. At this point, Larkin transformed his situation in the most dramatic and creative way. He brought a third woman into his life by initiating a love affair with his secretary of 18 years, Betty McAreth. After they became intimate, she immediately told him, "Don't worry, Philip, I will never, ever say a word to anybody." Nor did she, until more than a decade later, when Andrew Motion finally riddled out the clues. She has never forgiven him. Betty, as she says with precision, was not in love with him, but over the years had grown to love him. They were both in their early 50s. It would soon be too late. Betty recalls, "The whole thing took me by surprise. As far as I was concerned, we could have gone on as we were. We were good buddies." She felt excited by the new relationship, not having expected such a thing at her time of life. One element which drew them together was her attitude to marriage. As she says, "I knew all along, deep down, that I would never, ever in this life get married." On the other hand, her relationship with Larkin had some aspects of a marriage. "I knew everything a wife knows, more than some wives know, probably." She was enough of a woman of the world to be unconcerned by his taste for pornography, and the affair was happy and long-lasting. Over the remaining years, until Monica came to live in Newland Park, Betty would visit him in the evenings. By this time, their written correspondence in decline, Larkin rang Monica every night at 8 o'clock, and they spoke for an hour. If, by chance, Betty did happen to be there earlier, he would have to leave her in bed and go downstairs for the phone call with Monica. Betty recalls, "And if he didn't ring, she would have to know why. Where had he been? What had he been doing?" In 1975 and 1976, Larkin wrote 4 substantial poems addressed to Betty. She recalls the debates between them. "He said to me one day, 'I can't understand why you, on waking in the morning, don't think of death.' And I just looked at him, and I said, 'I cannot understand why you, on waking in the morning, think of death.' He said to me, 'My father died when he was 63, and I expect I shall die when I'm 63. And I said, 'Yes, you will, because you are programming yourself to die at 63. On the 17th of November 1977 came the death that mattered most. His mother died at the age of 91. His dearest old creature was no longer there to expect his next letter. The following day, Larkin kept an appointment with Anthony Thwaite at All Souls College, and asked his Anglican friend to accompany him to college prayers in the morning. "I think my mother would have liked that." Early the following spring, Larkin finally and momentously sorted himself out in relation to Maeve. "I still find it distressing to recall the details, let alone write about them," she said. Philip had finally determined to end the vacillation of 18 years and henceforth pledge himself to Monica Jones. "I reluctantly accepted his decision. What else could I do?" Larkin wrote to her, "I realize you're very hurt and that this explains the angry home truths. I know most of these are justified, not quite all, but they leave their sting. Perhaps when we feel better, we can meet again? I don't say this vindictively. I am extremely sad about it all. Dismay and puzzlement at Larkin's poor image of being a Tory snob with sexist and racist tendencies and a singularly unattractive man is universal among the women with whom he was romantically involved. All those who were close to him remember him with affection and feel privileged to have known him. Typically, they found him witty, entertaining, considerate, and kind. In March 1979, Larkin had seen a hedgehog several times in his back garden and had fed and taken photographs of it. Then, in June, he wrote to Judy Edgerton, "This has been rather a depressing day. Killed a hedgehog when mowing the lawn. By accident, of course. It's upset me rather." With Betty the following morning, he was less reticent. She recollects, "This day it was different from anything. He just stood at the window of his office, looking out, and said, 'I mowed the lawn last night and I killed the hedgehog.' And the tears rolled down his face." Later that year, Larkin agreed to give two interviews intended to consolidate his public image. The first, with Miriam Gross of The Observer, appeared in November and is packed with brittle and outrageous aphorisms as quotable as anything in Oscar Wilde. He dislikes public readings, he says, because I don't want to go around pretending to be me. You can't write more than 2 hours a day, and after that, what do you do? Probably get into trouble. Writing a poem makes him feel as if he'd laid an egg. In Philistine mode, he tells his interviewer, "I read everything, except philosophy, theology, economics, sociology, science, or anything to do with the wonders of nature, anything to do with technology. Oh, have I said politics?" He would like to visit China, but only if he could come back the same day. The Observer interview is his most exhilarating exercise in high camp wit, though there is also something of the self-epitaph about it. He simplifies his life into a delightful self-parody, claiming to have completely forgotten his childhood and wanly characterizing his parents as not very good at being happy. Librarianship was a good choice of profession for him, he claims, since it has just the right blend of academic interest and administration that seems to match my particular talents, such as they are. He likes living in Hull because it is on the way to nowhere. It's in the middle of this lonely country, and beyond there's only the sea. I like that. His final comment has persuasive gravity. "I want readers to feel, yes, I've never thought of it that way, but that's how it is." Lunching with a young colleague in the staff canteen of Hull University a few months before he died in 1985, at the age of 63, Larkin asked her how old she was. She told him she was 31. Looking down at his failing body, he declared passionately, "It's not fair."
In 1984, Philip Larkin declined to accept the post of Poet Laureate. After his death in 1985, Monica Jones lived on in his house in Hull until her death in 2001. Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love by James Booth, was read by Michael Pennington, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. This weekend, Six Music remembers a man who was part of our network for Saturday mornings.
His Peel sessions are legendary.
He was the champion for alternative rock.
I seem to remember that we did a special punk programme, but rather as they had done when we'd first played reggae, people had written in and said, "Come on, old fella, pull yourself together," as they do now with hip-hop.
But it was his voice and the man himself that we all adored.
Celebrating what would have been his 75th birthday.
Join us over on Six Music to just remember, through our memories and experiences, a true icon of British broadcasting.
When you're putting programmes together, you're trying to keep abreast of the interesting and exciting and energy-filled areas of music.
We all follow in his footsteps.
John Peel, remembered with BBC Radio 6 Music.
This Sunday at 1 p.m.
on your digital radio.